8:15 having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order. And members, yesterday we released the Education Finance Bill, and first of all, a huge thank you to all of the members for all of the input over the entire year. If you look through the bill, there are several provisions in there that are from both Democrats and Republicans. Want to thank the public, all those who came before us and testified, and those in town meetings around the state that gave views on how to make this an excellent education system. Thank the Department of Education for their excellent work and cooperation anytime we needed some advice or some information. So just a huge thank you to everyone as we put this together. And, you know, I think, and I'm confident when you really take a look at this, that I think we hit our number one goal. And that was to look at whatever we could do, look at research-based items and strategies and efforts that would improve student achievement and close the achievement gap. And we have set in this bill a very ambitious goal, and that is to put kids on the path to the world's best workforce. And we also have, to get there, set some very high benchmarks, if you will, to strive to make sure that by 2027, when our kindergartners who start in the fall of 2014, by the time they graduate, to try to establish the world's best workforce here in the state of Minnesota. And we do that by striving to get to completely closing the achievement gap, raising the graduation rate 100%, 100% third grade reading level, get everyone up to that point, and have every kid college or career ready by 2027. And folks might say, well, boy, this is really, really ambitious. But quite frankly, to not say that we are going to get every single student to graduate or to get to the same level of performance would be a disservice to that student and really to the state of Minnesota in our future. And what this bill says to every single student in this state is that we will never give up on you. And no matter where you live, no matter what your income, no matter what your status is, we are going to work to get you to the full potential, to get you ready for career or college. That's what this bill says. Will we get there on every single occasion? We may not. But the goal must be, the goal has to be, that every single student, not just 99%, but every single student get to the highest achievement level possible. And so how do we do that? And what are the benefits? Quite frankly, if we can get to the world's best workforce and we can get every child to where we need to get them, here's the benefits. And back on February 19th when we had the workshop, we heard the benefits from people who look at all of this. And if you get to the world's best workforce, you can close or reduce the unemployment rate by 2%. That's 60,000 jobs. According to economists at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, if in 15 years we can close the achievement gap, within that next 15 years we can increase our gross domestic product by 1.8%. That's $5 billion a year of increased economic development. By 2018, the governor's workforce says that 70% of all jobs are going to require some sort of post-secondary degree. We're about 150,000 jobs short of that right now. To put 150,000 jobs into perspective, that's the number of jobs we lost during the Great Recession. So we have to be able to do that. And probably most important, if we get there, allows us as a state to have the sustainable resources to be able to fund the high priorities we have today, education, and other priorities that will keep us a great state into the future. So what this plan really does is focuses on those strategies and efforts that really will get results and have a proven track record of doing that. And we start early. We start in this bill with a huge amount of investment in early childhood education and, for the first time ever, fully funding voluntary all-day, every-day kindergarten at 1.0. And I think it's important that we invest now to prevent the achievement gap rather than paying billions of dollars later in trying to close the achievement gap. And I think with an early start, that will help in long-term benefits. And then tremendous investment in resources, 2% in the first year on the formula and 2% the next year on the formula, to give school districts the tools to be able to get our kids to the world's best workforce. And a real key in all of that is efforts out of the policy committee and Representative Breinert and others with an assessment, a new assessment policy that make sure that we take the gains that we get from early childhood education and we take that all the way through the loop. And as you look through the bill, there are many, many areas on that assessment process where it talks about identifying kids who are off track or at risk. And we are going to make sure that they get back on course and then link up and align with our colleges so that our students are career and college ready. That is a real key. But we can put all the dollars we want into a system. We then have to make sure that out of those resources, we're going to get results. And so what is in this bill is an area that will require school districts to develop and implement strategic plans for student achievement. And what those will be, they will be local plans that do not, let me repeat, do not need approval by the Department of Education. But they will be a local plan that is developed that will indicate how the school districts, with their budgets, plan to reach and progress towards those goals that we've set to get the world's best workforce. They will need to do this at a public meeting, because remember, this isn't just a school board's or school district's or Department of Education's job to get students to the world's best workforce. It is every single resident in the state. So we have to have everyone involved in helping to set those goals and making sure that every year when the school district comes back and looks at the progress, to have input there. And then what I think is really exciting is using the governor's expansion of the regional centers of excellence to work with schools, just like we're going to work with students on the assessment, to work with schools, and if schools aren't making progress, to step in and ask, how can we help? And working together between the schools and the department and the regional centers of excellence. And if we're falling behind, we get help to continue towards there. If a school doesn't hit there, there's no cutoff scores. It's making progress. Is it going to be tough? Absolutely, it's going to be tough. But again, the goal has to be to get every kid to where they need to be. So I think that type of accountability system would make a huge difference. And you know, one thing that's important is that 97% of the dollars in this bill either go directly to the classroom, goes directly to parents for early childhood education, or go directly to property taxpayers to relieve taxes, property taxes, 97%. And so, members, the idea is that we're not going to give up on any student. And I think what this plan does, through where we're placing the dollars in very strategic areas, with an accountability system at the end, and with assessment process that is going to be effective in getting kids to where we want to go, I think we have a strategic plan that will get us to our goal of the world's best workforce. And so, members, again, that's I wanted to lay out those comments and thank you for your efforts. And I'm going to turn it over here to Representative Woodard for some comments, and then we will start going over the bill. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would agree with you that this was a lot of work, and I certainly appreciate the bipartisan approach to some of this bill, and we appreciate the working relationship that the Republican caucus has in this committee with the DFL caucus. So we're very appreciative of that. We find you to be a very fair, open, and honest chair. And so, again, as I've told you in private, I'll tell you in public, I don't think you'll ever hear me on the House floor complaining about this committee and the way it works. So I certainly appreciate that. I'll start off with the positive. We're certainly very appreciative that the money that you've allocated here is focused on the classroom. We think that's where it makes the most impact. We think that putting money on the formula is a good idea because it provides our local school districts with the flexibility to do the things that they need to do to make sure that when you graduate from their school districts that it means something, that a diploma means something. We appreciate the fact that you're taking the pilot program for the Early Learning Scholarships and moving that forward. We've got some concerns about the details around that, but certainly the concept is sound. We'd like to see that go farther. We'd like to see that go beyond just early learning. But it is what it is today, and we certainly understand the political reality of what's going on with our early learning scholarships. You know, when we talk about flexibility, though, within our school districts, we are concerned that that the plan today has less flexibility for school districts, that it creates more mandates, not less. It's got the anti-bullying mandate we know is going to cost our school districts. It's not paid for in this bill. We know that teacher evaluations are going to cost more in our school districts. We're not sure how much more, but we're not funding that. The special ed cross-subsidy we know has been talked about for certainly since I've been on this committee the last 3 years about dealing with special education needs. So our concern is that we're going to put more money into new programs without really addressing the economic needs of the programs that we currently have in place that we know that work. Also, and I know we're, I know what the answer is that on the school shift payback that, that's going to be dealt with in the tax committee. You know, we're concerned that House File 1 is not in this bill, that Representative Seltzer's bill to pay back the shift is not in this bill. That doesn't make it a priority by the Education Finance Committee that paying back that marker first is a priority. So we're concerned that that's not in there as well. But to wrap that up, again, Mr. Chair, this is a good start. We are hopeful and optimistic that with potentially a few changes that we might have a good true bipartisan bill here, and we're looking forward to working with you over the next couple of days to get there.
Thank you very much, Representative Woodard. All right. At this time, the plan is to go over the bill today. Members, as we kind of go over each section, if you have a question, feel free to ask that now. I think on a lot of the policy stuff, staff, that we've been kind of through it. So, I mean, we'll go over it, but kind of a little quicker through that part. I'm not referring to, I talked to Representative Woodard about this too. And if someone does have a question, ask that, but we have been through that. So what folks haven't seen are a lot of the financial parts, and then also I think there were a few changes probably in the policy since we heard it too. So members, if you have questions, or Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson, Ms. Larson, would you like to wait after each article to take questions, or what would be best?
Mr. Chair, it might be easiest after each article.
Okay, is that all right, members, if you hold your questions till after each article? That would be great. And then are you going to talk about this? I mean, all the members should have one of these,
yeah.
Which are, is that correct?
Yeah,
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, we thought we'd go through the overall statewide spreadsheets first, and then before we go through the bill, we'll talk about the district-by-district printout.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd first like to start out by going through the spreadsheet that's titled 2013 Session Appropriation Tracking. As you're well aware, the appropriations are the state aid component of the K-12 funding in our state. And so this is the spreadsheet that talks about the state aid. So the spreadsheet is laid out in order by, in general, by the articles of the bill. So the first article being general ed, et cetera. So, and then the columns going across the page, that you'll see the first set of columns is the current biennium that we're in, fiscal 12 and 13, and the current fiscal year 13. The next three columns are the February forecast for 2014-15, and this is considered the forecast base. So every proposal that we're looking at, whether it be the governor's or our House proposal, is compared to base. So that's a really important thing to note about the spreadsheet. The next set of columns is the governor's recommendation, and then you'll see the fourth column over from there is the difference between the governor's recommendation and base. And so that's how you can easily identify where his proposals change compared to base. And then the final set of columns is the House recommendation for 14 and 15. And the most important column to keep your eye on as we go through the spreadsheet is the fifth from the right column that says the difference from the House to the base. And this column is going to sum to the House target that was put in place for our committee, and that target is $550.2 million for the biennium. So we'll go through each of those items as we go through the spreadsheet. So, as you know, the biggest piece of the House's proposal is the increase in formula for both fiscal 14 and 15, 2% for each year. And so if you look at line 5, you'll see the basic formula amount in the base is currently at $5,224, and the House is proposing an increase of 2% for both of the years. So over that time, the per pupil funding would increase by $209 per pupil, and the new formula would be $5,433. So if you look at line 11, you'll see what that equals out to in terms of the dollars to fund that. For fiscal 14, it will be approximately $102 million. For fiscal 15, $213 million, for a total of $315 million over the biennium. The line 12 is optional all-day K, another centerpiece of the House proposal. It's assumed that there won't be 100% participation, but approximately 95%, either because districts don't have the space capacity to do it initially or because of parental preference for not going with that full day option. So we make some assumptions about what that will be, but there is funding for the full day for all students that are interested, and that's $105 million approximately for the biennium. Then that starts not in 14, but in fiscal 15. The next two items, lines 13 and 14, were recommendations that the governor had included in his budget and that the House has agreed to put in their target as well. And those two items are kind of minor things, but they're clarification of the kindergarten early entrance requirements. There's been some concern that districts have been, in some cases, not having a very succinct policy about admitting children younger than the age of 5 to kindergarten programs and thereby causing them not to be ready and having to repeat kindergarten. And so this program would require that the districts have a written policy that has clear criteria for students to enter prior to the age of 5. So this results in a net potential savings of about $3 million. Line 14 is the grade level acceleration changes, and this is a kind of a technical thing as well that limits the ability of districts to accelerate their child's instruction so that they graduate early. So this is kind of another technical piece, and that would result in approximately $2.5 million in savings. Line 15, the House proposal makes a great effort to take a look at inequities in the amount of per pupil funding throughout the state, either geographically or because of property wealth. And so the enhanced equity would guarantee that districts would receive, particularly in low referendum revenue areas or in low property wealth areas, that they would receive a minimum of $300 per pupil in equity funding. And so that results in about $13 million in 14 and 17 in 15 for a total of about $30 million. Line 16 is a referendum equalization aid. This is an attempt to address the issue that districts throughout the state have different levels of property wealth and are able to raise referendum dollars at different levels. And so to provide more equalization, state equalization aid to those districts that have relatively harder time raising the same amount of money. So that would take place beginning in fiscal 15 at approximately $33 million. If you then follow down to lines 30 and 32 under the general ed area as well, you'll see the non public pupil revenue, and there's also a non-public pupil transportation revenue. And both of these programs have the program funding mechanism is set up such that the increases in the formula are linked to these increases as well. So when the formula increases, these would as well. So there's about a $1.9 million increase tied to the formula increase. So on line 43, you'll see that the total amount for the first article, the general ed article, is approximately $480 million for the House target, and that's about 87% of the total recommendation. So a significant portion is in the first article. If you take a look at the second page on line 57, again, there's just another program that's tied to a formula increase, and so there's a 2% adjustment there. Line 60 is the student assessments, and I won't go into great detail here, but there's additional funding for that, and my colleagues will get into the details about that program, but there's some additional funding there to support the districts in looking at assessments and career planning for students. Line 63 is the collaborative urban educator. This is a program to support local colleges and universities that are training teachers who are represent underrepresented population to better reflect the student population that we have in our schools today. On line 68, you'll see the Minnesota Math Corps. That was a proposal that was brought forward yesterday, similar to the Minnesota Reading Corps that's been done through Serve Minnesota. Next one, innovation grants. There's $100,000 per year for that. The line 70, Principals Academy. That was another proposal brought forward. And similar to the governor, we've the House proposal has the regional centers of funding for regional centers of excellence and the school climate center. So those items there. And then for this current biennium, there aren't any specific changes for special education that has been noted. The next section is facilities and technology. It's not showing on this portion, but when we get to the levy tracking spreadsheet, you'll see that there's an increase for the Safe Schools levy that will be accounted for. On line 99, you'll see the school lunch increase. There's a state funding for that, and there's a 1 cent increase for each school lunch, and that would result in about $2 million increase over the biennium in funding for that. Moving on to the next page, we go on to another major component of the House bill, and that is the early childhood and family support. On line 130, you'll see the additional Head Start funding. As a result of the federal sequestration, there was significant cuts to some of the federal dollars for Head Start, and so there was an attempt to help support that cut in this first fiscal year in fiscal 14. Line 132 is the early childhood scholarships that have been highlighted significantly to provide scholarships to low-income families to be able to attend high-quality preschool programs. Line 146, adult basic education. This formula allowance has typically grown by 2% a year, or it had been at 3%, was decreased to 2%, and this, starting in fiscal 15, would start that back at a 3% level. And so that's phased in starting in fiscal 15. The next page is the three state agencies that are under the jurisdiction of the Education Finance Committee, the Department of Education, the State Academies for the Deaf and Blind, and the Purpich Center for the Arts. And you'll see that there's a base adjustment for each of those each of those agencies. For the state academies, you'll see that we did include funding for the oven upgrade, so that's one small piece. And so that total for the state agencies is approximately 1.7 over the biennium. And then on the last page, on line 210, you'll see that the target was $15,700,000. So the total over base relates to the $550.2 million. You may wonder, in fiscal 14, both in the forecast base and in the governor's recommendation, why there's decrease, or it looks like there's decreases in fiscal 14 when we're putting new money on the formula. And this is largely the function of the interactions of the shift. The shift was a big portion of it, $1.5 million was paid in fiscal 13. So because this is based on appropriations, the number for fiscal 13 looks very significant. But then when we get back to the regular funding, then it goes, it moderates. So if you look at the last set of numbers on pay on line 237, when we take out the interactions of the shift, that what those percentages are. Any questions on this, Bridgie? Okay, the next.
Thank you.
The next spreadsheet is the education levies, and each, and that's the other spreadsheet you should have in your packet. Each line in this spreadsheet corresponds to a local levy that schools are eligible to levy for, and the target for the House for this budget cycle was to have a zero levy target. So there was that was the ultimate goal, and this spreadsheet is outlined by the major funding or the major fund categories that the districts have: general fund, debt service, OPEB, and community service funds. So similar to the appropriations tracking, the columns orientate you to the fiscal years, and the first column you'll see fiscal 14, pay 13 certified. That levy has been recently certified, and so there won't be any impact for this for that year. Any changes that you contemplate or make would be take place in fiscal 15 or pay 14. So that second column there is considered the base, and the sixth column over, the House current law versus current law difference, is showing where proposed House changes are taking place. So under general ed, under lines 5 and 6, you'll see two different items. Because of the way that the formula increases, or the formula works, when there are increases in the formula, there are corresponding impacts for levy increases in areas like equity and transition. And part of the process in trying to keep the levy target to zero was to build that into on the general ed model, and so to have it not have the impact on the levy side. So you'll see that on line 5. Because in addition, as we were looking at enhancing the equalization, the same thing, we wanted to really reduce the impact on the levy, and so the equalization provides that property tax relief, and so that was able to be have a negative effect. Line 22, added equalization aid, you'll see we talked about this on the previous spreadsheet, that the equalization aid is an attempt to provide property tax relief to districts that have low property wealth. And so by increasing equalization aid, the levy is decreased by a significant amount, and that's reflected on line 22 here. But because we're able to provide that relief, there were some additions that we were able to provide in different levy areas. On line 35, you'll see the integration levy. For the base, that contemplated was that there would be no levy for that category, but the House has recommended to restore that integration levy as a part of the overall budget. Line 39 is the safe schools, and that would provide $5 additional per pupil unit throughout the state for additional funding in that area, and that would be about $4.4 million. Line 67 addresses the capacity issues that districts may have in implementing full-day kindergarten. So we provide, there's an estimate that about $1.2 million could be used for local districts to levy to be able to provide space for kindergarten. And then on the second page, under debt service, if there were a number there, let's call it 10.5, there's a Cyrus bonds. The Morris and Cyrus School District are in the process of going through a consolidation, and part of that process, the district needs to take care of one of its facilities or in a demolition, so they will be issuing bonds to take care of that, and will be issuing them, paying the debt service over a 10-year period, and the estimate is about $85,000 a year for that cost. So, but overall, as you can see on the last page, line 191, the net effect of all of the changes on the spreadsheet was to meet a zero levy target. Any questions on this page, on this spreadsheet?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm noticing there's a difference between the certified and the grand total, and then also looking at the integration, because for most districts, the integration plans have to be approved by the department. I'm wondering how much less from what was total possible was actually utilized in integration and the amounts and levies. Because I know of several districts within my area that do not utilize the full maximum integration funding.
Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, when we build our district-by-district estimates, we do look at the portion of the previous total funding available to them that they use. So under the old formula, many of the districts were able to receive up to $92 per pupil. 30% of that came in the levy. If that district chose to receive a smaller amount, maybe had a program that cost $50 per pupil instead of the $92, both the aid and the levy would be scaled back. So the estimate, the statewide estimate that shows up on the tracking sheet here of the levy reflects those, essentially reflects those under levy decisions that districts have made. So the total that you're seeing on here in terms of that new levy reflects that some districts are not levying the maximum amount that the formula would allow.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the equalization aid, is that an inflation factor that's been added on to there of some type?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there's two aspects of this. The first is that there's a higher level of equalization because there's the dollar value has been raised. But the dollar value, and we'll talk about this when we go through the bill, has also been tied to the growth in property tax base. So it's going to increase as tax base per kid increases in the state. So it's not an inflation factor linked to the CPI or the implicit price deflator, but it will grow as tax base per pupil grows.
Okay. So we'll be talking about that a little
bit
more. Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Any other questions? Very good. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair,
Strom.
Members, there's also a district-by-district printout in your packet. That's on the 8.5 and 11-inch paper, laid out landscape style. There's always limited room on paper to put the changes in, so we've aggregated them here. Let me tell you what all is in this printout. We'll have district by district detailed pages available fairly soon, I hope. The general education changes and total general education revenue are in. Statewide, that's about $7 billion of what you'll be seeing here. Special education is in this printout. As Ms. Johnson said, there's no change from the house to the base on that, but that's about $1 billion worth of base. So when we're adding all these numbers together to get the totals that we see here, $7 billion of general education, about $1 billion of special education. And then the other category, there's about $500 million of other things that are on here, most of those unchanged. Those include things like literacy, the career and technical levy, desegregation program, the alternative facilities, safe schools, school lunch, and concurrent enrollment. So all told, we've got about $8.5 billion of total revenue on a district-by-district basis that are showing up on these printouts. We often call this a total revenue printout. It obviously doesn't have some of the other building debt programs, debt service, doesn't have the community ed programs in it. But for operating revenue, it's nearly all the sources of operating revenue that the state is or local districts are involved with. So that's what goes into the totals that you're seeing here. The way the printout is laid out, it's ordered in district order. School districts are listed with their adjusted ADM pupil counts for both 14 and 15. And then the total revenue per pupil is shown, the house revenue per pupil is shown, the total increase, and then the increase per pupil and the percent change. So for example, the first school district listed is the Aiken School District. They have 1,202 pupils. Under the baseline revenue amount in fiscal year 14, we're expecting them to get $8,648 per pupil. The house plan would push them to $9,027. That's an increase of $455,000 or $379 per adjusted average daily membership. And the percent increase then is 4.4%. The same calculations are made for fiscal year 15. These are both measuring against base, and you can read across there the same things for Aiken there. And in the second year, Aiken gets an $835,000 increase or $710 for an 8.2% change. The top of the spreadsheet shows these grouped by category, by metro and non-metro. Our definition of metro we use is the seven-county metro area. We have something on here that actually messes up the calculations a lot unless we list it separately, and that's called the fudge district or the cooperatives line. What that adjusts for is students that we can't that we know are going to be in the system but that we can't allocate to any particular district. And sometimes the characteristics of that fudge line, which the department has developed and which works very well for our statewide cost estimates, don't make sense when they show up as a district number. But we've taken that out of both the metro total and the non-metro total. We just don't know where those kids are going to be, and you'll see that you get a negative increase in 15, but that's basically a junk line that's accounting for the 14,000 students. We don't know where they'll be and what characteristics they'll have. So in total, as you go through this printout, the bolded columns are the percent change. That's a per pupil percent change over base. As I said, we'll have the detailed district-by-district data for all the data that goes into this up on the website, hopefully in the next day or so.
Mr. Strom, mm-hmm. If you wanted to see what was the total increase in dollars for your school district over the 2 years over base, I'm presuming you're looking at the fourth column over where you at fiscal 14 house increase, and then the third from the right, which is fiscal 15 house increase, you'd add those two up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think school districts generally budget on a single year basis, not a biennial basis, but if you wanted the 2 year total, you could certainly do that. Add the total in that fourth column of data from the left and the third column from the right.
Okay. Members, any questions on the spreadsheet here? Also, members, if you notice, if you want to go to that fifth column over, fiscal year 14 increase per student, you can see there which districts are receiving that enhanced equity by, you know, the average is about 135 that first year. So like Aiken, if it's at 379, that's one that certainly is receiving that, which means it would have had a low referendum amount. And we bring everyone up to 300. And I'm wondering if we could also get a separate spreadsheet on just that component. Would that be possible at some point?
Mr. Chair, yes, that'd be fine.
Okay. So that's where those percentages that where you see some are very high, those are the ones that would be qualifying for that equity revenue. Okay.
Mr. Chair, let me add one other detail that's not on the spreadsheet. We haven't gotten the data to quite work in the way we're expecting it, and that is that on the special education formula, our revenue calculations, the revenue coming into each district for special ed is the same, but we're changing the tuition billing. We'll talk about this when we get to that section in the special ed article, and allowing the resident district, the serving district, to bill back only 90% of the cost to the unreimbursed cost to the resident district. We'd like to put that on the printout. We're still having some difficulties with that data. So on the net special ed, there will be some changes. This will particularly affect charter schools and perhaps some school districts that serve a large number of open enrollment children. But essentially what will happen there is 90% will be billed back instead of 100% of the unreimbursed costs. That's not in the printout yet, but I think that's about the only major funding change that doesn't show up on the printout.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, if you're ready to move on, we can start with the bill and go through that in a pretty quick manner for you.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, I'll walk through Articles 1 and 6 to 10, and Ms. Larson will go through Articles 2 to 5 with you. We've had a slightly different article structure this year. We've got a couple of more articles at the beginning, so we apologize in advance if we refer to things in the wrong article. We're kind of creatures of habit. You've got a bill summary in your packet that you can look at for a description of each provision, and the document we'll be working off of is the Delete All Amendment to House File 630. That document has a number in the upper right-hand corner of A13-0404. That's the amendment that will be in front of this committee, the one that we'll be drawing the amendments up to tomorrow night for tomorrow night's markup. Mr. Chair, members, I'd just like to highlight a few provisions in Article 1 that we've talked about some, but probably are more important to point out. Sections 1 and 6 relate to the kindergarten entrance requirements, and if you turn to page 7 of the bill, Section 6, this explains the provisions that a school board will need to do in order to allow a student under the age of 5 to enroll in kindergarten. These are part of the governor's recommendations on kindergarten, and essentially what happens is a school district is going to need to have a policy, not just be willing. Under current law, the school district can allow any student under the age of 5 on request to enter that program, the kindergarten program. This will require the district essentially to have a policy and some standards about how they're going to let children under the age of 5 into kindergarten. There's a couple of transportation provisions in sections 3 to 5 that we talked about just yesterday, so I won't review those today. Those are the same as what we talked about yesterday, with the one change on section 5 that's a little different than what we originally saw, and this is Representative Anzelk's provision regarding districts being able to use the actual contract rate for certain expenditures in the transportation formula. This language is on page 6 of the bill, lines 11 to 17. This is slightly different than the language that we heard when Representative Anzelk presented his bill. Instead of the department doing the check and requiring database to be developed to look at these contract rates, essentially what happens is the school district's got to be able to show that the variances in their rates are appropriate. So it eliminates the department's role in needing to oversee that contract rate. Mr. Chair, another provision that's probably worth spending a little extra time on is Section 7. This has to do with the early acceleration of grades that Ms. Johnson talked about. Essentially what happens under current law is that there was a provision for grade level acceleration, and you can see the struck language on page 7, line 34. And this doesn't affect the ability of a child to graduate early, but what it does do is limit the ability of a school district to claim additional funding for that child on the basis that that child will graduate early, whether or not that can be shown. And the reason the department had this in their bill is they were concerned that there were some school districts, primarily charter schools, that were only elementary in grade, that were showing that all of their children would be graduating a full year early and claiming the accelerated funding under this provision. So this section essentially will affect a handful of districts and charter schools, maybe 15 or thereabouts in total, but it will be a pretty significant change for those. The students will still be able to graduate early if they like, but a school district or a charter school won't be able to claim that a program is accelerating that student to claim extra funding during that particular year. Mr. Chair, members, Section 10 is where the change to the pupil weight is. This is on page 10.14 is the change for the kindergarten pupil weight. If a district continues to offer a half-day program, those children will still count as 0.612 pupil units, just as kindergarten children do now. If the pupil's in a free full-day, everyday program, they'll be weighted at 1.0. Mr. Chair, Section 12, Ms. Johnson's talked about the effects there of the formula allowance increase. That's where those changes are at. On the bottom of page 12 is the equity revenue section, and what you can see in the new language on page 13 is where the new $30 million of equity revenue gets spent. Essentially what happens is all school districts that have a low referendum, lower than $300, are brought up to at least that amount in extra equity revenue. For fiscal year 14, that amount is paid entirely in state aid. And in fiscal 15 and later, that goes into the equity formula as the regular equalized aid and levy. Mr. Chair, members, on pages 14 and 15, these are provisions from Representative Morgan's bill that you heard the other day regarding the uses of compensatory revenue, expands the uses to allow it at the early education programs, and also gives the additional 5% authority for school boards to allocate that money. Under current law, 95% has to be spent at the site where that money is generated. This would allow that percentage to go down to 90% if the district so chose, and could use the other 10% then at other sites or for the early education programs that are contained in the previous section. Mr. Chair, members, there's some cleanup language with the referendum program, and then essentially the main change there is the additional equalization aid that Ms. Johnson talked about. That happens on page 18, lines 7 and 8, where the equalizing factor, under current law, the equalizing factor is a fixed number, $476,000. As Representative Grunhagen asked, this is now indexed essentially to the statewide growth in tax base, and set at 122%, which is about $526,000 currently. So if tax base is to grow in the future, per pupil tax base were to grow, the aid share of the referendum would grow along with that. Finally, Mr. Chair, in Section 23, the Safe Schools Levy on page 19 is increased by $5 per pupil for school districts. Section 24 is the taconite provision that Representative Moline brought to the committee. And then Section 25, the new language on page 23, lines 2311 to 2318, this is the language that the governor brought to the committee regarding the 90% reimbursement, or the 90% bill back of the unreimbursed special education costs. Essentially what's going to happen here is under current law, if a student open enrolls or attends a charter school and that student is uses special education services, the regular formula pays the money directly to the serving district, and then any unreimbursed cost the serving school district or charter school incurs is billed back to the resident school district. This provision, beginning in fiscal year 2015, would allow the serving school district to only bill back 90% of the unreimbursed costs. And a couple limitations on this. One, it only applies to districts that to students who are open enrolled or attending charter schools. It doesn't apply in situations where a child is placed in another school district in some other manner. And secondly, there are exclusions for a couple of different groups. Cooperatives, special education cooperatives, and intermediates are excluded from this. And also excluded from this and still remaining at the 100% reimbursement would be a charter school where more than 70% of the charter school's student body is eligible for special education services. And there are three charter schools that meet that definition currently. Mr. Chair, I think that's it for Article 1. There aren't any unusual riders in the appropriations section, and Ms. Johnson has gone through those on the spreadsheet. These are the baseline appropriations plus the House changes that we've talked about on the spreadsheet.
Thank you very much. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, on the 1.0 for the kindergarten pupil, traditionally, is that what we've assigned to kindergarten, is a 1 instead of a 1.15 like we have for first graders?
Mr. Chair, Strong. Representative Woodard, the weighting for kindergarten students used to be at 0.5 and all elementary students used to be at 1.0. And then in the mid-90s, the legislature changed those weightings for the elementary grades, and we ended up at 1.115 for the grades 1 to 3 and 1.06 for grades 4 to 6. And in my mind, then, it's an open question what a actual weight for kindergarten should be. The additional weighting that was added to the elementary grades is added to something called the class size reduction reserve. And that money is required to be used to lower class sizes in elementary grades. That's why those funny weights were put on those early elementary grades. Many of the proposals that have funded full-day kindergarten have weighted the kindergarten pupils at 1.115. This proposal weights it at 1.0.
Okay, thank you.
Also, Mr. Strom, on page 20 on the safe school levy, if you notice, members, on lines 20.1 through lines 20.5 are some additional uses for safe school levies.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I forgot to put those mention those as we were going through this. Those are a number of the uses that were brought in bills before this committee regarding additional uses of the safe schools money.
Very good. Article 2.
Mr. Chairman, members, in the interest of being brief and not repeating yet again what the committee has already heard, what I'd like to do is summarize what's in Article 2 and mention just a few of the changes that are also included. The base for this document reflects what the Department of Education proposed in House File 1151 that Representative Mariani, as the chair of the Policy Committee, authored. The MDE changes largely reflect changes to standards and credits in 120B and were explained as an effort to better organize language pertaining to standards and credits. In addition to the MDE changes, there are a number of other bills that are included in this article. Representative Breinert's bill 1337, proposing changes to the statewide assessment system, are here. Part of Representative Breinert's bill includes a career or a career pathways and technical education task force, and Representative Erdahl in House File 734 had a similar proposal as well. In addition, there is a bill that Representative Bly proposed, House File 685, that proposes to establish alternative routes to a standard diploma. He includes a direction to the commissioner to make recommendations for implementing this proposal. Representative Dabney's bill, House File 477, proposing to establish a high school diploma for adults, excuse me, and authorizing the commissioner to adopt a rule to affect this proposal based upon recommendations from a task force report. Also, what we have here is a proposal which the chair described in some detail in his introductory remarks on the world's creating the world's best workforce. It appears on page 47 of your bill. There are several components. The first component is to list the goals for effecting this workforce by 2027. There's a requirement and a process for developing strategic plans to affect those goals and to provide support for realizing the goals. Regional centers of excellence are established that have relationships with both the department and the local districts. Finally, in that same proposal, there is a requirement for an evaluation so that success can be disseminated throughout the state and support can be provided if districts are not making adequate progress toward realizing those goals. In addition, one of the changes you'll see for the transition in the statewide planning for a new statewide suite of assessments appears on page 33 and elsewhere. But on page 33, you will see the list of alternative assessments. The transition applies for students enrolled in grade 8 through the 2012-2013 school year. And currently in the bill, the alternatives are several. One is to take the grad in reading, math, or writing, to take the suite of assessments to the extent they're available, laid out in Representative Breinert's proposal, to take the work keys job skills assessment, or a computer adaptive college placement test, or the ACT. And Mr. Chairman, that's a quick run-through of Article 2.
Okay. Members, questions on Article 2?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mariano.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, something that was sort of implied but never really fully talked about when the department came in and did some changes when they were clarifying language around standards. They had struck some old language where we had inferred what the cycles for revision would be for the standards, and by striking that old language we were left with not even an inference of how often the cycles, or rather the standards, would be evaluated, revised. And so what we did is we took it didn't make sense to put in those old dates, But we just worked off of the difference between those old dates and the prospective dates. And so we put into our language here 6-year cycles for ongoing revision of our standards. Obviously, we'll continue to debate that with the Senate, with the Department of Education, and obviously into the prospective year on whether or not that's the appropriate cycle range for standards revision. But basically what we did is just make sure that we were using the same number of years in cycles that were inferred from the previous language. So I just wanted members to be aware of that.
Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the student assessments, I know we've got a number assigned to that as well. Do we have a fiscal note associated with the cost of doing the student assessment?
Yep. Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, on line 60 on the second page for student assessments, it was assumed approximately $6.5 million, $2.4 million in fiscal 14, $4.1 million in fiscal 15, and then you'll notice there's a line item number 67, the Get Ready, Get Credit Ed Planning and Assessment, that was funding that we then discontinued in the base for that program and rolled into the new assessments, and so for a total of $7.3 million.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Woodard.
So, Mr. Chair, do we have the actual notes on the fiscal note? I mean, is it available online? I mean, I saw the line item. I'm just curious the background on it. Yeah, sorry.
Ms.
Johnson.
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, the Department of Education has been revising their numbers on that, and they gave us a worksheet the other day that's not an official fiscal note, but is a worksheet of how they've broken that money down. We'd be happy to find that for you and provide that to you that shows the dollars in each of those categories. We've got that on paper somewhere here, so we'll find that and get that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
Anything else on Article 2? Representative Grunhagen.
On that, the striking the eighth grade graduation test and then coming up with the new statewide testing for the ACT, it repeals the requirement that students have to pass the statewide test. Is that correct?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, the grad test requirements go away. The MCA test requirements do not.
So,
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I understand correctly, they still have to pass the MCA in order to graduate.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, they have to take the MCAs. Passing the MCAs is not a graduation requirement.
Okay,
Representative Grunhagen.
The just a note of consternation on that is that we're eliminating the need to pass a specific test. They have to take the test, but they don't have to pass it. And then later on in the bill, we want, by 2027, we want 100% graduation rate. Well, if you don't have to pass the test, and you're going to get 100% graduation rate, okay? I mean, from my perspective, it just smacks of social promotion, which is a philosophy that has gotten us into the difficulty of just passing children along, regardless of whether they can show academic knowledge at a particular level. And then when they graduate, they can't read their diploma, all right? And so I really have some consternation about not requiring some type of a passing grade on a test to show a certain amount of academic proficiency before you give a diploma out. Now, am I misunderstanding, or that's my conclusion, at least initially.
And Representative Grunhagen, what I'd like to do is if you have questions kind of on the technicalities, I think on Thursday, tomorrow, when we go over the bill, we can discuss exactly what you're talking about right now, if that would be all right.
That'd be fine.
Okay, very good. Any other questions on Article 2? Okay, Article 3, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, in an effort to be brief and not a repeat for yet another time, provisions that the committee has heard before. I'd like to quickly summarize a number of the provisions that do appear in Article 3. Included among them is a school calendar provision that was contained in House File 261 that Representative Newton authored. Representative Winkler's legislation on EpiPens, House File 688, is included here. Representative Yaruso introduced a bill on teacher basic skills and temporary teacher licensure. However, the repeal of the basic skills requirement, which was contained in House File 1257, is not included in this article. Licensure regarding teachers of deaf that Representative Seltzer introduced in House File 1006 is included here. As Ms. Johnson mentioned previously, we do have legislation from Representative Morgan, House File 1003 on the Math Corps. Representative Erdahl introduced a bill on coach complaints, saying that the basis for not renewing a contract could not be the existence of such complaints, House File 984. That's included. A number of provisions offered by the Department of Education pertaining to American Indian contributions and establishing a director position in the department, which were included in House File 1151, are included here. Representative Mariani's bill on achievement and integration revenue, House File 247, is here. Representative Benson introduced a bill on student services, House File 363, which was amended with a delete everything amendment. Well, that language has been removed. However, there is a request to the commissioner to make recommendations to the legislature on providing student services through a professional team approach. And there are a number of school climate council provisions, both from the department in House File 630 and from Representative Dabney in House File 826.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Article 3, questions on what is contained in there? Very good. Article 4.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, in an effort to be brief, Article 4 is the charter schools article. It is comprised largely of two pieces of legislation, one being provisions related to charter schools offered by the department in House File 1151, and also legislation that Representative Mariani offered on behalf of the Minnesota Charter Schools Association, 1089. Those comprise the majority of the sections. There is also a section directing the reviser to make a technical recodification of the charter school laws. Section 124D10, which is often referred to, has become very long, and the proposal is to create a separate statutory chapter for charter schools.
Anything on Article 4, members?
Sure.
Representative Mariani.
Never mind.
Very good. Anything else on Article 4? All right, we'll move to Article 5.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Strom and I are going to share responsibility for this article.
Very good.
The policy provisions contained in Article 5 come from two sources. The principal number of sections in this article come from the Department of Education. Their testimony indicated that the purpose of these sections was to allow state statute to conform with changes in the federal IDEA Part C. In addition, Representative Dabney had a bill on restrictive procedures, House File 771, and that language is included in Article 5 also.
Mr. Chair, members, in terms of the financial provisions, Article 5 contains the governor's special education proposal starting 2 years out, so starting first in fiscal year 16. This would essentially convert our formula from its existing cost reimbursement formula to one that has some census counts, and essentially the formula in here is similar to the governor's. The difference is that the specific dollar amounts for some of the activities, these are on page 127. As you look through the initial aid calculation on section 18 of Article 5 on page 127, You'll see that these numbers vary somewhat from the governor for a couple of reasons. One of those, it starts another year later in fiscal year 2016. There's also a slightly expanded hold harmless there to try and limit the shifting because the overall amount of new funding put into special education compared to the governor's in 16 over base is different than the governor's amount in fiscal year 15 over base. But the end result is a system fairly similar to what the governor proposed, where there would essentially be formula-driven amounts for many of the special education costs incurred by districts. Mr. Chair, I think we talked in Article 1 about the special education unreimbursed costs. So I think that's really all I need to say about the special education funding. Oh, one last point on that. The increase on the tails that Ms. Johnson went through for the appropriations sheet, you'll see that there's an extra $30 million over base for the combined biennium 16-17 to pay for some of the increase in special education funding. So that would be on top of the 4.6% growth that there's another $15 million per year added in.
Members, anything on Article 5? Article 6.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 6 starts on page 134 of the bill. Two provisions that were heard yesterday in Representative Daphne's bill regarding the authority for the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts to issue general obligation bonds without voter approval are included in this section as sections 2 and 3. Section 4 was one of the first bills this committee heard this year. Representative McNamer brought the bill regarding the Cyrus and Morris school district consolidation. And in terms of the riders, I don't think there's anything unusual in the appropriations there. One last little point in on page 134, the very first appropriation section is for the debt service program, debt service equalization. That's currently what we call a fixed standing appropriation. We're making that open and standing so each year we don't have to adjust the dollar value in statute for how much aid is paid out under that program. There's no practical effect to this. It will just save us when we're putting the bill together from getting the wrong numbers in again and again and again. Mr. Chair, Article 7.
Any questions on Article 6? All right. Please proceed. Article 7.
Mr. Chair, Section 1 of Article 7 puts an additional 1 cent for every school lunch served. There's about a million school lunches served each year, so that or 100 million rather, so that 1 cent turns out to $1 million per year. And then on Section 3, this committee hasn't seen this provision before. This is similar to a bill that Representative Erickson has introduced that extends the ability of school districts, the flexibility of school districts to transfer funds from one fund to another or one account to another. As long as that increase that transfer does not increase a state obligation or result in a property tax change. So that would be the same authority as we've got now with one additional restriction, and that shows up on page 138 on lines 1 and 2, and you can see the additional restriction here is that the staff development reserve in 128.61, that revenue in that account is not allowed to be moved out of that account under this provision. Mr. Chair, I think there aren't any riders on the appropriations here for this article. I should add Section 4 on page 138. This is new language to the committee. This section, essentially what this uncoded section does is require that any increase in school funding be paid for on a percentage basis of 90% in the current year and 10% in the following year, and that essentially the second sentence of this provision says that the legislature cannot recognize any aid savings on any increases in school district levies from here on out.
And Mr. Strom, that's assuming then that the shift gets paid back. Is that the assumption here?
Mr. Chair, others would have to assume that. That's not in this bill.
So. Very good. So that the tax committee will need to do its work, so which is expected. So very good. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming that lines 1 and 2 on 138 still allow for the negotiation between the union and the district on that 2% as in the past?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes.
Anything else on Article 7? Right, Article 8.
Mr. Chair, Article 8 is the Early Childhood Self-Sufficiency and Lifelong Learning Article. The first section is your Youth Council Bill. I'm sure this committee will look favorably upon that.
Mr. Strom, if you just hold on for a second on that, you'll notice there is the Minnesota Youth Council, which we did not hear in this committee. The bill was heard in the Early Childhood Committee and then sent to Government Operations, which I then actually thought it was going to go to the General Register, as it did a couple years ago or last year when it went to the floor and passed. But then they sent it here, so here it is. And so this youth committee, they do have members right now that are advisory to the Minnesota Department of Education, so there is already a link. But it's something that actually members who were here last year or 2 years ago, the last session, would have seen. But basically, members, what it is working with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, which has worked since the late 90s with all the current lieutenant governors and so forth. And it would assign members or recruit members from all of the 8 congressional districts. And then actually twice a year they would come down and have committee meetings where they could ask members to, if there's bills dealing with youth, they could have members come forward and talk about that. They could actually propose, of course, through members, legislation and so forth. So what it's doing is it's giving youth a direct voice into the legislative process. And the idea behind that is not only give youth a direct voice, but also have a kind of a direct connection with legislators with that age that is basically 13 to 19. So it's been done in several other states. There's absolutely no cost to this at all. And we already have a group that is well established that would do the recruiting and does all of that type of thing. So I think it's a nice initiative that will really get youth involved right here, kind of give them a voice under the dome, so to speak. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that the bill that you had presented on the House floor? Was it last session or the session before?
Yes.
And I voted against it?
You might have. It did pass, but yeah, you might have voted.
Yeah, and I think I did.
Representative Grunhagen, I don't keep track of the yes or no's.
But you will.
Yeah, I was sitting right not too far from you, so I just happened to remember.
That, yeah, that's correct. And I don't think it went out of the Senate, but it did. Did pass off the House floor
it passed.
Last year, yes.
Yep.
So I think it's almost identical to the word. But so anyway, I just wanted to be up front. It is in here, even though we did not hear this before the committee. And actually, I thought it would be sitting on the General Register, and they sent it here, and I just didn't. I just left it here. So very good. Anything else,
Mr. Chair? 8? Then Section 2 of Article 8 is the Early Learning Scholarship Program. In its current form in the bill, this is exactly how the bill was heard in this committee, with one change, and that is on the dollar amounts, and those show up on page 147. The dollar amounts here, you can see that Ms. Johnson talked about for the current years are $22 million over the base of 3 for a total of $25 million in 14, $31 million in fiscal year 15. And then the tails for this program are $52 million in 16 and $75 million in 17 and later. So that's where the difference is currently. I know there was some discussion about on page 143 on subdivision 11 here, and I believe there'll be an amendment that addresses about on page 143 on subdivision 11 here, and I believe there'll be an amendment that addresses that. But currently, regarding the student identification number, as that was raised at the time that the bill was heard in our committee. But currently the language in this section, in Section 2, is the same as the language that was presented to the committee.
Okay. Anything on Article?
And Mr. Chair, just two other quick changes here. In the state total adult basic education aid, that's on page 144. That starts with the growth factor increase to 3% starts in fiscal year 15. And then the rider language here on the Head Start program on page 146 is new to this committee. On lines 146.19 to 146.22, the additional money for Head Start is going out only in fiscal year 14 and is equal to the lesser of essentially half of the revenue loss due to sequestration, or the amount that's appropriated here, which is the extra $2,071,000. And the distribution of that money is required to be proportionate to the sequestration loss and not under the regular state distribution formula.
Any questions on Article 8? Mr. Strom, where are the scholarship dollars? Where was that?
Mr. Chair, those are right on the top of the next page on 147, the 25 and 31 million. And then you can see the tails amounts of 52 and 75 million on lines 147, 7.
The innovation grants.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
The innovation grants are back in Article 2, or 3, Article 3.
I let's go back there, because that is new, and something we didn't hear either was that. What page is that? Page 82. If you remember back in the policy committee, the chairman of this committee proposed an amendment that was roundly defeated in committee. And it dealt with the site decision-making grant program, and Representative Erickson had commented on that. What we do here is, in fact, not change any wording, but part of that law, since the beginning, had a grant component. And so what we're doing here, actually, is just putting some, activating the grant after all the years, and actually, so there's no wording as far as what we were talking about, Representative Erickson, in committee that day, but this just actually enhances that and puts some dollars. So if schools need some dollars to do this, there's some grant dollars for that. So members, we didn't hear that. We did hear that in policy, and so there's none of the amendment that was there that day is here. It's just now going into the current part that has a grant that was never activated and putting some money into that portion. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, it was both chairs that were soundly defeated on the on the policy change language. Obviously, we didn't bring that back here, but I think it's appropriate to fund this existing program.
Thank you. Very good. I think we've got another two articles.
Another two articles, but we can do those in less than 2 minutes, I believe, Mr. Chair. Article 9, starting on page 148, is the state agency budget. Ms. Johnson talked about the dollar amounts there. You can see the riders that exist on the Department of Education budget. The ones that are listed there are the ones that are in base budget. Small change on page 149, the licensure by portfolio was formerly going to the Board of Teaching, and now as an administrative function that will go directly to the Department of Education. And then as Ms. Johnson mentioned, on 149.16 through 18 is the kitchen facilities money for the Minnesota State Academies. Otherwise, Article 9 is the baseline language with the higher budget basis for the three different agencies.
Anything on Article 9? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to understand why only two of the children museums in the state are singled out for funding and not the other ones.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, I actually don't know the history of why those two accounts are assigned to us. I know for those appeared for a number of years, there was an early education committee, and those became a ridered line item there, but I don't know how that committee arrived at those, and they've been part of the base budget now for several years, but I don't know that how they came to be.
Mr. Chair, the question was more as to why the exclusion of others. So my impression of the statement was this is sort of carrying on from the past, but in the past we maybe had fewer, and I do know that over the last few years there have been additional children's museums because the children across the state gain quite a bit from this. And therefore, I am a little bit puzzled and perplexed that only some of the children of the state have their children's museums funded here and not others, and why we are excluding large portions of the state from this.
Okay. Representative Mariana, is this to this point?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Mariana.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Klum, I'll get you more accurate and specific information, and we may, depending what happens in the markup, we may want to have someone come and briefly share. But the Minnesota Children's Museum, a large part of what they do is, in fact, to provide access to children all across the state. And it's a very impressive record of school districts having arrangements with that particular museum to bring students down for a structured full-day program. I don't know whether that's true of the other museums or not, but I think you and I can kind of work together to get more information on that. But just in terms of the Minnesota Children's Museum, they clearly have embraced a statewide mission of providing educational services for students across the state.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I could understand if that was, because I agree with their broad reach, but I noticed Duluth, which is what, the fifth, sixth, maybe seventh or eighth largest city, is here, but Rochester, who's the third largest city, who now has a children's museum, and it's excluded. Mankato, which is a growing regional center, is excluded. I really don't understand it. Once you go beyond the main state children's museum, why you pick one and then exclude the others that are in regional centers. But again, I'll cover that offline. But I just, when we do stuff, this is a bill for the state, and I really don't like when it becomes picking and choosing groups.
Yep, right. And to this point, Representative Reiner.
Yeah, very quickly, Mr. Chair. I want to second that issue. I think that some of this is a historical funding structure, and that it's not just a Mankato Children's Museum. It's the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota, and they do strong educational outreach in the whole of South Central Minnesota, and it's been there for 6 years now as a structure and moving into a permanent facility. And I think we might need to look at the historical record here and understand how we could move forward in a more equitable manner.
Okay. So we might come back and revisit that. Very good. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you or staff comment on why the department is getting the portfolio dollars for licensure?
Mr. Chair, we talked to Ms. Ballmer about this to make sure we had the right dollar amounts in, and she informed us that that function was moving to the department. I didn't ask why. I'm sure we can ask her that and get right back to you.
So, all right. Anything else on Article 9? Then Article 10.
Mr. Chair, Article 10 is the forecast adjustment article. What this does is it corrects the appropriations that are wrong in the previous fiscal year, and it does ups and downs. The idea is that this committee, when it funds a program, intends to fund it at the right dollar amount. If it overfunds it in the following year, we go in to reduce that funding. If we underfund it, we go in to increase it. These amounts are in the forecast, so there's no change from forecast at all by doing this. It's a way of clarifying our numbers and making them more accurate. One thing that's happened this year because of the shift effect is you'll see that nearly all these appropriations are ups. That's not usually the case, but they're all up and by quite a substantial amount, and that's mainly the impact of the shift being repaid, a portion of the shift being repaid in fiscal year 13. So whether or not this article passed, we shouldn't have any effect, but we save a lot of reallocation headaches in the meantime by changing these to the accurate amounts or more accurate amounts to fund the fiscal year appropriations.
Thank you very much, Representative Klum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to get this correct, that this section more accurately represents what the past budget that was, you know, 2 years ago, and that we're finishing up that biennium now. So this actually gives the true final, so to speak, picture, which is what, about $1.5 billion greater than the original picture. And then in the earlier spreadsheets reflects a 36% increase from the previous biennium. Is that a correct interpretation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes, that is. It's not quite final yet. Fiscal year 13 will still have some changes to it, but it's much closer than it was when we passed the bill back in 2011.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Well, Ms. Larson, Ms. Johnson, Mr. Strom, thank you for not only your great work today, but a great work during the session and putting this bill together and tight time constraints. Thank you for everything. Members, we have some time to take testimony, and we could start that, and then we'll continue testimony tomorrow morning and discuss the bill tomorrow morning, and then maybe 30 minutes after session, we will come back and then do amendments. That's still the plan. So if anyone would like to start testifying, we would start taking that right now, even if you're not just fully prepared. All right, so come forward, please. We'll... And as she's coming down, we'll take minutes. We have some April 9th, 2013 minutes to approve. Anyone care to? Representative McDonald, have you thoroughly reviewed those?
Certainly have.
Representative McDonald moves the April 9th, 2013 minutes. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. The minutes are adopted. Please welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, which is a division of Legal Aid. And I've been before this committee before talking about a bill carried by Representative Newton and Representative Winkler talking about concerns about children being turned away from lunch counters when they don't have money for lunch. And so, you know, I come this morning to see this bill and see just so much money poured into school districts across the state, yet we still are not looking at telling schools not to turn children away from lunch counters. And I'm just deeply disappointed, deeply surprised, because one of the most affordable and effective ways to close the achievement gap is to ensure that hungry kids are fed. And so I hope that as conversations move forward on this bill in the next few days, that this committee will think about how you still might address that issue. Right now, what this bill does, frankly and quite honestly, is it subsidizes millionaire kids for their school lunch. You're increasing lunch money for a penny across all lunches. So you're giving money to kids who get a free lunch. You're giving money to millionaire kids. And it's the kids in the middle that are still going to get turned away from lunch counters that are completely going to fall through the cracks. So I just really hope that there's a renewed conversation about looking at either, if you're not going to fund the children that are being turned away from lunch counters, then please, if you're giving schools $2 million more for school lunch, please, please, please tell them to stop turning children away, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds who don't have money for lunch, to stop turning them away from the counter, because it's a fair ask. It would no longer be an unfunded mandate. It would be a very fair ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Webster. And remember, I'm going to ask that we take testimony, and then we, if there's questions after, we can call folks back. Most will be here. But anyone else this time would like to testify? Please come forward.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue after Holden with NAVI Minnesota, and I'm fine with not coming back later, so I'll take the opportunity to testify now. First, I just want to thank you for including the language so that we can educate young people about mental illnesses. Also, that we would allow teachers to get more intensive training and deeper training on mental illnesses and autism and those types of issues. I really appreciate that. Also appreciate increasing the safe school levy and allowing it to be used in a variety of ways. Would like to see the intermediates also be able to increase their school levy as well. And would also ask that you look at perhaps expanding it just a tiny bit more, that in addition to the collaboration with mental health services, also providing technical assistance on to decrease the use of seclusion restraints in the schools. On the seclusion restraint language, again, I think we've made some really good movement forward with this language, really clarifying what an emergency is, because we only want these procedures to be used in emergency, improving the local review of when these happen, because the only way you can actually reduce their use is to use data and to examine the data and look at, you know, what happened, and so how can we do this differently. and then also increasing the training for teachers so that we can really reduce their use. One final comment is that under the regional centers, I would also ask that you look at not only the collaboration with children's mental health providers in those areas, but again, looking at providing technical assistance to schools to reduce the use of seclusion restraints. These things don't happen overnight. It does take a lot of training and a lot of help, and we know that with certain kids, people are just at a loss of what to do. And so if we're really committed to reducing their use, we need to make sure that schools and school personnel have access to that technical assistance. But I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Very good. Thank you so much. We will have time for one more. Welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair and board members. Mary Saccone, Parents United. There's really a great deal of things to be really pleased about in this bill, so I just want to thank you for your time. But I do want to point out that the one thing that I have talked with parents about that they're most excited about is this change in testing. The fact that as the kids go through school, they may actually understand what they need to do in order to potentially get into college. So I just want to praise that work by the committee, because that's one of the most important things. And then trying to make sure that there are dollars so that these types of things can actually happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Members, tomorrow we come back at 8:15. We will hear testimony and then have time to start talking about the bill. And then tomorrow night we will cover amendments. And we'll set the deadline for noon, I think is what it is, for tomorrow for deadline for amendments at noon. Members, thank you. We're adjourned.